This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about the TSP, learn more about it, and who better to learn us is Greg Long, Executive Director, Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. I always mess that up. I don't think I did it this time.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Good to see you again. Kim Weaver, Director of External Affairs, Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Good to see you. And Tammy, co-host of the show, Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, knower of all things federal.
Good morning, Bob.
Good to see you. Okay, so what was the first question? I forgot already. But let's ask the first one that's on the list. How do the furlough days affect the participants' TSP accounts? I'm sure the listeners will want to hear that first.
Sure. Well, what we were going to talk about, first of all, is why we're working today.
That's right.
The furlough does not affect us directly because the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board is funded by the TSP participants, that's our funding source. So we're not funded by appropriated dollars. As far as the furlough, you know, we're not affected. We certainly know that our participants are impacted, but we continue business as normal. So participants can call the TSP today, check on their account, do anything they would normally do.
They can still apply for loans if they're not in a pay status, or is that something that they would have to wait?
No, they can still apply for loans.
That's something that some people are probably starting to think about as time drags on.
Right. And so we are seeing a spike in our phone volume. So we, of course, have two phone centers, and they're always busy, a little bit more busy over the last couple weeks.
And we also have two fact sheets on our website, tsp.gov, that may be helpful for people who have been furloughed.
And what's on the facts?
It's talking about if you are furloughed, what is the effect on your, if you have a loan outstanding, if you want to take a loan. It just provides you some background on what to expect vis-a-vis the TSP and you being furloughed.
All right. We had some email questions come in, and one of those was on the TSP loan. What's the turnaround time on a normal loan, if you will, maybe not in the high volume situation mm-hmm. we are in, higher volume? Mm-hmm. Is it a week? Is it 2 weeks?
Our standard processing time is within 5 days of us getting the package and making sure that all of the signatures are there. As long as it's filled out correctly, almost all the time, we turn that around within 5 days.
Okay. Now, is that wired into their account or is it sent via the check?
It depends. We can do what's called an electronic funds transfer, which would go direct to the participant's account, presuming that they provide us with that information. Or we can do it via check that's cut by the Treasury Department. Of course, if it's done by check, you have to add a couple extra days for the mail.
Okay.
Right, and that is at their election.
And then when do the payroll deductions start once the loan is dispersed?
It's usually the month afterwards, but it really depends on the individual payroll.
And you pay yourself back plus the interest.
Right. So the loan rate is set at whatever the G fund rate is that at the month that you issue it, and it's very good to point out that you're not paying us, you're not paying any institution, you're paying yourself. What you're doing there is, if you choose to elect a loan, then you're taking a certain amount of money that would have had market returns, and now you're guaranteeing yourself simply G fund return on that money. That might be a good thing, depending on your situation, and it might not. It really depends on the opportunity cost of the money that you're taking out of the market.
That's true.
Could I ask you a question with mm-hmm. that? What if I didn't need it right away, but I knew I needed it soon? Could I do an interfund transfer and transfer everything into the G, and then when I make application, everything comes out of the G. After I get my loan, I reallocate it back to the other funds.
Could you? Yes. I don't think you need to.
Okay.
The money will, whenever we take a loan, it's reduced pro rata among your allocation. And so, if you wanted to do that, Bob, you certainly could. I'm not sure if it's going to be helpful in getting to where you want to go.
I'm always trying to put myself on the other side of the earphones. And then the second issue is, and this came in last week, an individual took $7,000 out of their taxable IRA, and they were under a certain age. They were fed and were surprised of the taxes and the penalty. And I just thought to myself, why wouldn't you take it out of the thrift? Or if you had that kind of money, you could transfer the IRA money into the thrift, not any type of IRA, but generally anything that's fully taxable, into the thrift and then replenish what you borrowed.
Yeah, that brings up another point, though, because employees can also do a hardship withdrawal, right? If they have a specific hardship situation, I guess this could be one of them for some employees. And if you were deciding between a hardship withdrawal, which is where you take the money out and don't pay it back, versus a loan, can you talk about the differences between that?
Sure. And we have talked about this a lot, is what's better. The hardship withdrawal, it's limited in purpose, but one of them is negative cash flow. And right now I know that because of the furlough, because quite frankly, your spouse might have lost their job, they might really have negative cash flow, so you would qualify for a hardship. And that is a way to get money out, but you are permanently reducing your capacity to grow your account.
Right.
And the loan, is a temporary, and you're paying yourself back. So of the two, I would prefer the loan in most cases.
Is there also a restriction on being able to contribute once you've taken a financial hardship?
Yes. So for 6 months, the thinking there is that if you need a hardship, that means you don't have money, therefore you shouldn't really be willing to
contribute.
Capable of contributing. So for 6 months post-hardship, you are prohibited from making contributions. One of the things that we've seen is, this really is something we want to eventually attack, is people stop contributing because they have to for 6 months, but 6 months turns into 6 years.
Wow. They just never restart.
They never restart. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's just one more behavioral aspect of taking out a hardship that I find to be unattractive. But as you said, Bob, putting yourself on the other side of the microphone, sometimes you need it. You know, you have to pay the mortgage, you have to put food on the table. In some cases, you need it. And it's good to know, even though that we provide a vehicle that's designed to help people save in retirement, this is also real life. And if they need the money now, there's a mechanism to get it.
And there's information on this both on the website. And do you have a YouTube? I know you have a YouTube channel now. Is there any videos that are available that can explain this to people?
We do. Tammy, thanks for bringing it up. TSP4Gov is the official YouTube channel. And we launched this last year. And our communications department Sophie is the deputy director there and has kicked this off about a year ago. And we now have 6 or 8.
14.
14. Holy cow.
But I would say be careful, because when I went there and I looked at some of them, I started seeing, you know, how they populate more YouTube videos.
Yes.
Some of them weren't from you.
Yes.
Right.
But they were still TSP in nature. Right. So you got to really be careful. How would you know that it's an official TSP YouTube versus just somebody who records themselves?
At the bottom, when you're looking at the YouTube sort of little box there, if it says TSP4Gov under the picture,
then
it's from
know.
Us.
It's from you. Okay.
If it says something else, it's not us.
Yeah. Okay. Because I found them very helpful. I think they're very explanatory. And some people like that visual versus just reading something on paper on a screen. So
it's one of the things we've done in terms of the homework, and we're getting better at this, is we had spent years and years of creating communication materials that were accurate, that didn't miss anything. But people don't read as much as they used to, and maybe the younger generation expects to have
video
and the amount of information they need delivered when they're ready to absorb it. And so the YouTube channel has allowed us to try to build on this. And we're learning, quite frankly. You know, we're just getting started and we're learning. But it's a way for us to get across, you know, very quick messages in 2 or 3 minutes that answer some longstanding, you know, miscommunications and misunderstandings.
Do you also have other social media like Facebook and Twitter?
We are kicking it around, but as of today, no.
Not yet.
One of the things that we are looking at is, you know, should we have a presence on LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter? And we just want to be really careful in that. Anytime something goes on there, it's useful, but you have the potential for something to go viral, and you need to make sure you have the capability to respond to it the right way. And so we're going to take baby steps.
That's probably wise.
Yeah.
Did you see that viral video where that young lady quit her job to a Kanye West song and danced? It's fabulous. It went viral last week.
Yeah, they weren't off last week.
No.
Anyway, here's what.
That one we didn't watch around the office. I can
so
tell
she's,
you.
She's on the Queen Latifah show last Friday, and Queen Latifah offered her a job.
Oh.
It was really neat, yeah.
So she's no longer unemployed.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to this. There's some anxiousness that we see in the emails about the G Fund's safety. You know, the government, if it defaults, you know, how will this impact us? Can you explain just how it works? And I'll say one thing because I'm an accountant. I pulled down the audit report last night because, you know, I said, well, maybe I should look at that. And for those of you all listening, auditors, if they audit something of this size, they have to put all kinds of ornaments. They're called footnotes. And if there's any degree of potential problem, they have to highlight it in those footnotes. And it wasn't there. Otherwise, the accountants can be sued.
Right.
So let's get back to the positive side, why nobody's got to be sued.
Okay. Well, so as far as auditing goes, and this is not just about the G Fund, this is about everything we do, we are required by law to hire a financial auditor. And it just so happens our financial auditor is a firm called CLA, and they're in our shop regularly looking at all of our financials. The Department of Labor, in addition, by law, hires their own auditor, in this case KPMG, that comes in and audits us for program purposes on everything we do. We also are audited by the GAO and multiple other groups. So we have auditors in our shop all the time.
I'm sure Congress is watching you too.
Yes. And that's fine because our intention is to be an open book, and we are. Now, The G Fund is the never had a bad day G Fund. It invests in non-marketable securities from the Treasury Department. What it is it's every month that the Treasury Department takes a look at all of their bonds that they have outstanding between 4 years and 30 years, so that what they call their mid or long-term bonds. And whatever that, the weighted average of that, that is the G Fund rate. And there's a substantial amount of money there. There's over 40% of the total TSP assets are sitting in the G Fund. We're right now in the period of what we call extraordinary measures, in which while that fund normally every day matures and accrues interest, when you're in the extraordinary measures period, then they can say, the Treasury Department can say, nope, we're not accruing interest daily. But to the participants, it means nothing. To the participants, their account values are exactly the same. They can still do transactions, do loans. The difference is that when they want, by law, the Treasury Department must make up the difference to the benefit of the G Fund and the TSP when this is over. And that has been looked at, the law as well as the mechanics behind it has been looked at, and there's an audit report along with a letter from the Treasury to that effect, and we post it directly on our website.
All righty. There was another – he's a prolific emailer, and he asked some good questions. And one of the questions was, why don't you offer XYZ Fund? XYZ Fund has done well, but it's a mutual fund of healthcare providers, if you will. So I thought, gee, I wonder if the C Fund has these same stocks. And darn if the top 10 holdings in this fund aren't in there's 6 of them are in the C Fund. And if they're not in the C Fund, I got to figure they're in the S Fund.
Yep.
How many stocks are in the S Fund?
So we'll break it down. So the C fund is designed to match the Standard & Poor's 500. So effectively, the C fund is the 500 largest domestic stocks in the country. The S fund is the mirror image of that. So it's the other of the total market of 5,000 or so securities. 500 are in the C fund, the other 4,500 approximately, and it changes, but the other 4,500 are in the S fund.
So there'd be no overlap that one would be in both?
Zero. There is zero overlap, and that's one of the requirements. Any security that is held in the C fund cannot be held in the S fund and vice versa. So there is zero overlap, but together, the C fund and the S fund together are what designed to be a total market index. So in effect, every domestic security, every U.S. security is covered with those two funds. So yes.
I don't want to sound like a homer here, but what you really got is you've got 5,000 stocks that certainly are in many, many specific mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, and I mean, I don't want to pick on this one, but it could be anyone. And if you're going to invest in a mutual fund, generally you want, you know, a large one with a mm-hmm. good track record.
Yep.
And now you got what they're buying. And you're exposed to other benefits as
right.
well.
Now, this participant was requesting a sector fund. And I do mm-hmm. want to pay attention to that for just a second, because that's not what we're designed to do. We invest in broad indices of the total market. We do not try to pick winners or losers. We don't say the healthcare is going to be better than the consumer non-durables market, or the technology is going to outperform the airlines. That is not a call that we are attempting to make. All we're saying is we're investing in the entire domestic large cap market and small and mid cap market. It takes us out of the position of wanting winners or losers. We want the whole market to do well, and it allows the participant access to that market. If they want a sector fund, we're just not the right place.
But you kind of sort of get it.
Well, you get everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you get exposure to everything. That's the point.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that. Congress set it up that way to take politics out of this. They foresaw that the TSP would become a very big repository of money, and they didn't want a situation where Congress or the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board was doing anything to pick winners or losers, because they foresaw that could become a political issue and a political problem. So we're set up to be passively managed index funds for a reason. And it's not accidental.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How about this? Furlough days. How do the furlough days affect the participants' TSP accounts? When they get called back in, when does the money go in?
Whenever it gets sent to us, that we'll contribute it that day.
Yeah, and they'll get their matching and automatic agency funds, yes, just as they normally would, as long as they get paid back for the time they were off.
Yes. Yeah.
But the money will be invested when it's received.
Yes.
Not back to the date they would have received it.
Right. Yeah. That's the way it has happened before, and that's the way I anticipate it would happen again.
Yeah. A real elementary question, that because I know a lot of the people I talk to in seminars, the only investing they do is in mm-hmm. the TSP.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they take money out of their paycheck and they go to the bank and they put it in, and they yeah. know where it is and they know where they can go get it. So sometimes they want to know, when the money comes out of my paycheck and it goes to the G fund, Where is it physically? Like, where is my money?
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain like a little bit about the path the money takes when it comes out of payroll and goes to TSP and you invest it for
okay,
the employee?
Well, there are a few different paths depending on the way the payroll works. But
right.
in general, what happens is the participant through their payroll office makes an election, and they might say 3%, 5%, 10%, whatever it is of pay. It's usually done as a pay, and that can be done either through a form or through an electronic system. And then whenever the payroll is sent to us, we'll get an enormous batch file. Usually the uniforms is once a month, and with the civilians it's every 2 weeks, and there's some cats and dogs in there that do it on a weekly basis. So once that money comes to us, we get an enormous file. We verify that that's set up correctly, because every once in a while you get some things in there that are anomalies. And then as soon as we verify that the file is correct, we in turn call Treasury and say, okay, the Department X has sent us 100,000 records for a total dollar amount of Y. They verify that it's accurate. We tap the account in Treasury, and then that comes to us, and then it is invested in the G fund, whichever fund they have that day. Mm-hmm. The whole thing takes about 2 days.
Okay. That's interesting, because a lot of people just don't know that path, because they physically know when they take their paycheck to the bank what happens, mm-hmm. but they don't really know where this money disappears mm-hmm. out of their paycheck and where it sits. And I think that gives them maybe a little uncertainty sometimes, or just less confidence, because they just don't understand that.
Well, and I know it might be cumbersome, but one of the easiest ways to do it is just go on the website and check, mm-hmm. Because you can log on to your website any day, and you will see a contribution. It'll say, $212.16 contributed on day X.
Yep. And your participant statement is on there as well when you access mm-hmm. your account. You can look at the annual accumulation of what's been happening, mm-hmm. some historical. Yeah, that's helpful, and I think a lot of people maybe don't check on that as often as they should.
One of the things we added to the annual statement, which is usually some good news, is on the quarterly statements you can track each individual investment. But on the annual statement, that got a bit too cumbersome. But we did add a feature that says your total lifetime contributions. Hmm. And so if you're – and for some people, they can say, okay, over my entire lifetime, I put in $50,000. And then they took a look at the total balance, mm-hmm. and the total balance is $100,000.
That's pretty
good
cool.
news. Yeah. I put in 50. The government put in some
that's
for
tangible.
Me.
I can see that. I can feel
and
that.
And then the market did some good stuff too. Yeah. And so what my 50 turned into 100.
Or 150 if you got the agency match. And the
Right, yeah, depending upon when and the market. And
that's great free PR.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah mm-hmm. That's a nice feel-good item that's on there.
And the other question I get, one more thing about that, and then I'll go back to Bob, is what about beneficiary designations? Can they check that online? Like who did I designate?
You can call us up, and we can do that over the phone. Okay. This is one of the things that we're working on right now as far as what we call a business process reengineering. We'll eventually be able to do that online, but we have to do a little bit of homework.
So if you didn't save your employee copy, then you need to call the TSP.
Right.
Okay.
You call us up and we can verify it over the phone.
And who it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Who you elected.
Right.
We'll take a little tangent here, and I'm staring at Kim with this one.
Okay.
And you know where I'm going with this.
I'm a little nervous.
No. You were. You wrote the memo on it. And unfortunately, an individual passed, and they were a Fed and saved and had a lot of money in their thrift. They named their spouse the beneficiary. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the spouse passes 3 months later. The children were the beneficiary of the surviving spouse, who has now passed. They have to pay tax on the money.
Oh, that's Larissa. You're confusing me with Larissa.
The attorney.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For your listeners, last year we had the one of our tax lawyers in here. That was Larissa.
Yes.
But yes. So if
I'm kicking that one to Greg.
Yeah. If you had a participant who's it would go in the order of precedence. So if you had no designation on file, and this is one of the things that I think is important that I focus on, while there is what is called a TSP-3, a designation of beneficiary form, it is not a required form. As a matter of fact, for a lot of people, not filling it out is usually the wisest choice. Because by law, we would provide it according to statute of precedence, the mouthful for me, sorry. But that means the money goes to your spouse if you have one. If they are deceased, it goes to your kids. If they are deceased, it goes to your parents. And so there's an order of who gets it. And if any of those people are deceased, you know exactly who it's going to go to next. If there's a form on file, we ignore the order of precedence and we pay attention to the form on file. And so that kind of depends on what's on file and who do we go to next. But there is a very defined process that we go through.
All right,
if it is the spouse that's the beneficiary, they can have it maintained in the TSP in a spousal account. And this is where this question came up, because the participant left the money to their spouse. It went into a spousal account. Mm-hmm. And when the grown children inherited mm-hmm. it, they were going to try to move the money into an inherited IRA. And we're told that they couldn't do that.
So that is a good point in that the beneficiary account is a very useful tool, but it needs to be understood. And this is a little bit of inside baseball, but we'll go here. If you're a TSP participant, you die, it goes to your spouse. That is a good place for the spouse to consider as to where they want that money to end up. But if you want to use – and if they're going to spend it during their retirement life, a very good place for it. If you want to use it for estate planning, if you're worried about leaving that money to heirs and minimizing the tax impact on it, then you probably want to eventually transfer it out of there before you die to an IRA.
Mm-hmm. That was something that we weren't even aware of until that happened with this one case. That was a good point to make.
Right. I guess I want to focus there that we're a retirement plan. And so we are focused on making sure that we maximize the ability for people to pay their living expenses in retirement. What we are not is the tax minimization, estate planning, financial preparedness, right. Counselors.
But that information is in the tax booklet, which
it is.
Yes, it is.
Never read it that closely, but now I did.
Yeah.
Well put, mm-hmm. And anybody listening to this, listen to it once or twice, rewind, listen to it before you quote it, because when I do it in class, what do you mean? But if you just do it slowly, or somebody's not married, there is no spouse, it goes to, let's say, the kids, if they're kids or somebody else, they might be able to put it into an inherited IRA. But we're getting into a legal tax planning session, and that's not what we're here for.
No, but that was a good point to make, because that does come up now in seminars quite a bit.
Okay, so this is a Tammy question. Has the 3-year pay freeze had any correlation with TSP participation?
The answer is not really.
No. The numbers are still up. We still have, 86 or 87% participation?
We were thinking about this. We were talking about this around the office. Is the participation rate has stayed pretty steady. And so I would say there hasn't been a big impact on the pay freeze. But what we haven't seen is what we thought we would see, which is we instituted automatic enrollment, and we thought we were going to slowly tick up. We've done a little bit, but not quite as fast as we might have otherwise. So
we probably haven't hired that many employees over the last 4 years either.
So long story short is, has it had any meaningful impact?
No
it hasn't. The good news is while it's been hard for everybody, we're affected by the pay freeze too. We feel it. The people have still contributed to the TSP, and that's good news.
Across the age groups, is the participation rate about the same, or do you find that older folks tend to contribute more because they're looking at retirement in the face and the younger employees have other obligations?
So we don't have as good data on this as I would like. It's one of the things we're actually going to spend some time trying to get over the next couple of years. Generally, what we have seen is that the younger participants have contributed at lower levels, and they've been a higher percentage of goose eggs, these zero contributors. And we've seen higher contribution levels among the higher age group. So we, of course, like to change that, or we would at least like to bring...
Level it out.
Yeah, level it out. But we think automatic enrollment is helping us there, and we've seen some evidence to that effect. But we really need to do some more homework on really getting underneath, what drives different cohorts to do different things.
And with employees who have been participating for 25 years, who maybe have spent the majority of their career in the government, do you feel that those employees have balances in the TSP that are preparing them for retirement? Are those balances high enough that these employees should be well set to, to complement their Social Security and their FERS benefit?
Like a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, but I'll give it a lawyer answer. It depends. And so we have seen certainly
I know there's some million-dollar accounts.
Yes, and there are what we are seeing is that the typical participant who has been in there for 25 years, contributing at least 5%, and hasn't taken loans or hardships, is fine. When you put that together with Social Security and the OPM annuity, you're going to have replacement ratios above 70%. sometimes even higher.
I had a funny story at a seminar one time. I came in the morning at 8:30 to start teaching, and this woman runs up to the front. She says, "Before you start, I want to ask you a question." I says, "What's that?" She goes, "I need the name of a good attorney because I want to sue the government." Uh-huh. I was like, "Why?" And she says, "Well, 25 years ago, somebody talked me into FERS, and I took their advice, and now here I am, and everybody says I made a huge mistake." I said, "Well, before you hire an attorney, let's take a look to see if you really would want to switch back." Uh-huh. So I made a line on the flip chart, and I showed her FERS on the left. You know, I knew what she had. She told me her TSP balance and her other accounts. And I said, "Here's what you would have had if you stayed civil service." I said, "Are you sure you still want to switch back? Because the number at the bottom on the FERS side was much heavier."
Yeah.
And she's like, "Oh, well, why is everyone saying I was stupid for switching?" I said, "Because they don't understand that compounding growth." And I think because they told you that, they did you a favor because you really forced yourself to contribute more than maybe you would have in your TSP account, because she had a very healthy balance in the thrift, and I showed her how much she'd potentially have to lose. So she sat down and...
So one lawsuit averted.
Yeah. Was quiet the rest of the day.
No, it's of course, you know, when I started this conversation by saying it depends. Mm-hmm. And while I don't know about this particular participant, but you know, if she was doing at least 5%, making sure she wasn't missing anything and didn't run into the situation in which, you know, she had to take a hardship or a loan, then yeah, you're fine. But there's a lot of people who are leaving, are not contributing 5%, some at zero, and then you get some folks that are habitually drawing on it for loans or hardship, and that just eats away at your growth potential. Now, sometimes you have to. We talked earlier, you know, mm-hmm. that sometimes life gets in the way and you have to. But if you can work on the regular program the way it's designed, most people are just fine.
Yes,
okay, one more, and then I think we need to open the phone lines. Here we go. I ask you this every time you come on. With regards to the ability to take monthly distributions from the thrift, one of those allows the participant to control the dollar amount and change their amount once a year. And we've talked, and you said that you – I'm not going to say anything. That I got the impression that you would like to see it twice a year, but I don't want to say that. Mm-hmm. But I understand that any change has to go through Congress, so you just don't go to Congress and say, "We want to make this one change."
Well, the – I don't know that – so we have a project going on to look at exactly this, which is, you know, should we take a look at some additional withdrawal flexibility. And I don't have anything – I'm not going to make any news today. So we have nothing to report other than to say we're looking at it. And I don't know yet whether that would can be done through a regulation change, which means Congress wouldn't need to be involved, or it would require Congress.
Okay.
But we are looking at our withdrawal flexibility and should we, you know, modify it.
Okay, time for the callers. 202-465-3080. Give us a call. 202-465-3080. And I think the question should stay on the TSP. We ought not to be doing benefits
and taxes.
Right,
yeah, well, we have this wonderful
like
opportunity. Let's stay on topic. Yeah.
Okay. And I
hear the phone ringing already.
I hear it ringing, but maybe one quick question. I don't know how quick you can answer this. You keep your expense ratios extremely low. And how do you do that when others either can't or don't want to?
Well, as we said earlier, we use passively invested index funds, and we have 4.6 million participants. And so between those two, we are able to keep our fees quite low.
Plus, and how about how much money is in there?
Well, yeah, the $370 billion helps.
Oh, that amount.
Yes, yeah. It does indeed.
And there are some forfeited contributions when an employee leaves the government in less than 3 years. That 1% agency automatic stays in, and doesn't that help as well?
Yes, it does. That defrays our expenses as well.
Every January, we do a
report, and it's public, and we say, you know, exactly how much we were able to defray because of the forfeited expenses. Mm-hmm. And, yes, it's meaningful.
Good.
I do believe we have a caller on the line. Do we? Good morning.
Not yet.
Not
He's
yet.
Working
okay.
on it.
Can I just jump in?
Sure. I think so.
I said earlier that the YouTube site was TSP4Gov. I want to just underline it's the number 4, not F-O-R. It's
good point.
The number TSP, the number 4Gov, and that way you'll –
as opposed to for your benefit, which is F-O-R.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's not F-O-U-R, it's the number 4.
Very good.
Okay, now, good morning. Hello. Talk to you later.
Not yet.
Okay.
We're working on it.
Monthly distributions. I think people are unaware that there's two options in the monthly distributions.
More than that.
I mean, there's you either take it over your lifetime or you call the shots.
You can also purchase a monthly distribution annuity.
Well, that's buying an annuity.
Yeah, but I mean, still a monthly payment.
But this is leaving the money in the thrift and saying, I want it monthly or I want to change my mind once a year. If you take it monthly, it's written how you... the percentage that you're going to get if you look at the IRS tables. If you buy the annuity, you can buy it with some of the thrift, all of the thrift, half of the thrift. But before you buy an annuity, as good as the thrift annuity might be, they're all pretty interest rate sensitive, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if you feel interest rates are going to be headed up and you are considering the annuity, you might want to wait a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, and so our annuity purchase activity has been climbing a little bit over the past few years, but not that much. And I think it is likely that it's because the interest rates are
so
at historic lows.
And once you purchase that annuity at a low interest rate, it stays that rate.
Right.
So if the other rates go up, you're stuck with it.
We are hearing, and this is we don't have enough data around this yet, but we are hearing that just the idea of making sure the money lasts for the lifetime is an important driver. And so the annuity purchase is a way to get that, to get guaranteed lifetime income, whether you live to be 140 or however long you live. So when interest rates eventually go higher, we'll see.
I think it might increase.
Okay, we got the caller on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have two questions.
Tammy, you had a bunch of questions, and it didn't all get on the website.
Well, the one thing I wanted to bring up, because I get this question, because sometimes we have a lot of older employees in our seminars that are already past their 70th birthday. And so they wonder, do I need to start taking out the money when I turn 70 and a half if I'm still working? Or when I separate from government, how soon will I have to start taking the money out?
So how
do I get notified?
If they're still working, they can contribute to the TSP and leave it right where it is. If you're 70, if you happen to be a senator or a member of Congress or a judge or that often work into their 70s and 80s.
Now we're getting feedback. That didn't work.
The participant, they can continue to contribute for as long as they work.
That's good. And once they separate, you will notify them.
Yes, we will notify them.
As long as you can find them, right?
Yes. And that is a very – I'm glad you brought that up. That is one of the very important things. If you're an active employee, the payroll office controls the address we have on file. So if you're not getting things from us, check with your payroll office to make sure you've got a correct address there. Once you've separated, then you can correct your address with us directly to make sure that you get the notifications that you really are going to need.
That's what I tell employees. I say the most important thing to do when you leave the government is find that change of address form if you move.
Absolutely.
Is that they don't have to do it while they're working because payroll does it for
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing that Tammy recommends strongly is look at your beneficiary form, right?
Because we always see situations where you wonder if somebody meant to change it and they didn't, and it's too late.
Exactly.
All righty. We noted the transfers out of the F and the G fund in July at the same time that there were increases in the S and the L. Is that because people are understanding diversification better? I mean, we kind of track these reports that you all sent out. And you're not going to say that, but do you see that?
I think there's some good news in there over the last several months. We are seeing... So the L funds, the life cycle funds are designed for people that seek diversification and to modify that diversification appropriately over their lifespan. So we're encouraged by people using the L funds to a greater extent, and that's good news.
And it simplifies the whole process for them, so they don't have to make those decisions about what's hot and what's not.
Correct.
They just put it in there and forget about it, basically.
When I speak, at seminars, I'll the way I explain this will normally be like, the lesson you learned in second grade is correct. You don't want all of your eggs in one basket. The hard part is figuring out how many baskets you should have and how many eggs you should put in each basket.
That's a good analogy.
The L funds are designed to do that for you, and to modify how many eggs are in each basket as you get closer to your retirement age. So we're pleased. We're pleased about the movement we've seen towards the L fund. There's other activity going on. And that is certainly when volatility climbs, people run towards safety, and so people go to the G fund. So there's no one trend. There's always 4.6 million trends, and we aggregate them to try to take some themes out of it.
Right.
All right. I think it was, last year, maybe 2 years ago, Tammy and I and some of the other NIT peers were down at an OPM conference, and they said, Greg's over in the lunch line. And I go, what's he doing here? So I went up, and you were very serious. And I said, hi. And you go, hi. I said, what brings you here? And then you looked at me, and then I got it. And to his credit, I've never seen this. He sat behind a lectern, introduced himself, talked, and then he walked away from it, nothing in his hands. Hands weren't folded, and he says, have at me. He didn't quite say that. He says, ask any question you want. And this was right after the, I guess, let's call it the cyber attack.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so one of the emailers said, what's been done to make sure that never happens again? I don't know that you can ever do that, but there was some firewall issues that you were going to fortify.
Sure. So just to give everybody an update, there was a cyber attack, not on us, not on the federal agency, but on the contractor that we hire to help us with our technology and enterprise services. We were, of course, not happy about that because in the process, we had some data on a group of participants that was released that shouldn't have been. We, of course, took steps to immediately shut down the affected computer, to protect that network, to scan all the systems to make sure that we had no other infected devices, and to effectively stop limit the risk of that happening again, so that there was immediate action that was taken. We also had action and outreach to the affected participants. We sent them all letters. We provided free credit monitoring to all of them, and then we tracked to see whether we've seen any fraudulent activity on any of those accounts. We haven't. So that's all good news. We have also rebid our technology and enterprise services contract, and that's going to a different vendor than the one who was previously attacked. And with that new contract, we are building in very robust provisions around security and making sure that we're able to keep our data and the participants' data secure. Can we ever be 100% positive that we'll never get attacked again? No. But we are building the most robust processes and walls that we possibly can.
I know when I first met you, that was the one thing you said that keeps you up at night is making sure that nobody gets into that system. That's the biggest worry you have.
Well,
worry, but that's the thing that would really bother you if that happened.
And it does. We have to recognize that we have the data and money of an awful lot of people. And as long as that is true, we will be a target. And what we're now able to do is to recognize that we will be a target, we will be attacked. What are the most robust defenses that we can possibly build while still being customer friendly? Because quite frankly, the safest thing we can do is just shut everything down. No phones, no computers. You have to write everything by mail. But that's not going to work either.
No.
So we have to balance the security and the customer service. And I think we have gone leaps and bounds in that regard. The other thing is I think people were asking, who did it? What's where do you get with this? And that's the investigation of a crime that belongs to the FBI, not with us.
Okay, you mentioned rebid, and I think last time you all were on, you mentioned one of the funds, you rebid the managers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And not necessarily the funds, it could be the annuity. Are any rebid processes coming up for any particular fund or the annuity?
Well, we don't announce upcoming things.
Okay.
We do that via public notice, and we do it on the website.
Next question.
So, but we certainly have been very active in the last year on procurement activity. I mentioned our technology, that's, you know, the people who help us run the systems, and two of our funds we recently announced.
The F and the I funds have been rebid and awarded.
Have they?
Yes.
Who got them?
The BlackRock, the incumbent.
Yes.
The incumbent.
Okay, there's nothing wrong with the others, but BlackRock is a nice name.
It is. Yeah. It is.
And we do each of these independently, and we what we do is we do our best to get to get secure, robust competition. So we do everything we can to make sure the marketplace of investment managers is aware that we're doing this. We're very clear. We post the RFP. We evaluate it, and we select who's in the best interest of the P's and P's.
How often does the annuity contract come up for bid?
Usually every 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
I think
MetLife has held it
for a while.
The whole time, pretty much.
Yeah, they have. And
they're huge, and that's probably part of the reason, because they can handle that kind of workload.
And they have to do business in
every state.
Yes,
every state.
That was the other thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a satisfaction rating of 86% that you all earned.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Do you keep on top of that?
So actually, Tony's here on my left. Led the
hi, Tony. Tony says hi.
Yeah, Tony says hi. Led the survey report we did last time, and there's another one that we're starting that's going on right now. And so we're very pleased with a satisfaction level of 86%. It's, if you compare us to kind of the rest of the world, the marketplace, I think we're better than average. I think while we're quite good, we also have some things we can work on too. And that's one of the things that the survey is intended to help identify. One of the messages that came out as far as we've got an awful lot of people that are very happy with the TSP in general, understand the fee structure, and are pleased with the level of customer service that we provide the access. I think there is some areas for a sense of greater help in understanding the big picture. You know, mm-hmm. How does the TSP fit into the whole FERS package?
Mm-hmm.
How can I make smart decisions and, you know, consider all the stuff that is foreign to me? You know, we're asking people to understand what a bond is and what a stock is, and they never learned that in high school.
No, we didn't.
Yeah,
no,
we didn't.
And so, but how do you, and knowing that we can't, you know, necessarily go have the Wayback Machine and teach you, how do we help people make smart decisions? And I think we've got some gaps that, you know, we're never going to be the sit next to you consultative advisor person, but I think we do have some areas in which we can improve our levels of service.
So are you a Rocky and Bullwinkle fan?
I am a Rocky and Bullwinkle fan. Yeah,
me
the Wayback Machine.
Yeah, the Wayback Machine.
As I knew I heard that somewhere before.
Anyway, sorry to get off on that, but not many people would know that. All righty, Tammy.
The other question I had was not really a question, but just I remember there was a time when 1 out of 4 TSP accounts were 100% G fund, because mm-hmm. we always called that the safe fund.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned over time that safety sometimes can also be not so safe because of inflation risk, mm-hmm. which is one of the risks of the G fund.
Yeah.
Do you still see that there's a high number of accounts that are still 100% G fund? Is there still
yes.
that group of people who feel that that's the safest place to be? And are they mostly people who have separated and CSRSers, or is it across the board?
So, yes, there are a substantial number. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I think it's higher than 25%. I think we're up to about 40%.
It's 47.
47%, really? Yes. Yeah. So, there's some of this may be rational
mm-hmm.
In that if you are, you know, as the population generally gets older, our population gets older, because we're a microcosm of the country. And so you get older, you get closer to retirement, you should be more conservatively invested. But then some of it might not be rational. Some of it might be you're 25 years old, you got automatically enrolled, you just haven't given any thought, and you're sitting in the G fund.
Right.
And we are, when I talked about doing homework, that's one of the things that we want to do more homework on, is understanding what is driving a large portion of our participants to be 100% in the G fund? Is it because they've thought about it and they want to be there, they understand the risks and the returns, or is it they just haven't thought about it?
I think it's because we used to call it. I remember when the TSP started and I worked in personnel, mm-hmm. we called it the safe fund, the stock fund, and the one we don't know what it is fund.
Okay.
And I think a lot of employees just felt
we want the safe one.
we related the G fund to putting money in the bank with a better return.
Mm-hmm.
And I
right.
think we need to change that stigma or that way we look at it with education.
The interesting thing needed. Is the average account balance for someone who has all their money in the G fund is $32,900. And if you contrast that with someone who has all of their money in the L fund, the average account balance is $115,000.
Oh, that's a huge difference.
So as Greg was saying, there's cause and we don't have the cause and effect. We can't say mm-hmm. that one led to the other, but it is a reason to be interested, and people should be thoughtful about where they're putting their money, because that is quite a wide gap in account balances.
Well, the way I answer the question when it comes up in class, people will say, well, should I do the L funds or should I try to diversify on my own? And I always answer that by, because I'm not a financial planner or a tax person, but I always answer that by saying the L funds are better than doing, and I'll just leave it open, and they'll say nothing. I said, no, the L funds are better than doing 100% G,
yeah.
because I feel like you're getting some exposure, even though it's limited, if you're in the L income especially, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, it's a little bit of exposure to the rewards as well as the risk of the stock market.
So on a related note, one of the things we're thinking about, and I'll be talking about with our board over the next few months, is the default fund. Because right now, we of course set up an automatic enrollment a couple of years back. When so if somebody started with the government and they didn't say anything one way or the other, then they'd be automatically enrolled at 3% into the G fund. Maybe that contributes to the fact that we have so many people 100% G, and maybe we should be defaulting to an age-appropriate L fund. And that's one of the conversations we'll be having in a public way over the next few months.
Good.
All right. We need to bring this down for a slow landing.
Okay. We did have calls. We just couldn't get them. We had technology problems today. So thank you for calling. We're sorry we couldn't take your calls.
You can email us, and we'll give you an answer, nitpinc.com. NITPINC.com. Now, some people have asked for Greg's and Kim's email address. I don't think we're going to do that, but certainly they can contact the thrift folks at?
At. So what is the phone number?
1-800-TSP-FIRST.
Okay.
Right. Yes.
TSP.gov.
TSP.gov. I will give a plug here just to make sure people know this. If they go to tsp.gov, log into their account, we have go in there, and you can send a secure email in the account, and that'll be answered usually in 24 hours.
Okay. Final comments, Kim?
Just keep participating, and we feel people's pain. We hope they continue to stick with the TSP.
Tammy?
I'm going to leave it up to Greg to give the final comment.
No, just that we are... It's an honor and a privilege to help 4.6 million people retire with dignity. And we're going to keep on earning our trust every day.
And same for us having you here. Thank you, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
This Friday on FCA Answers, it's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We'll explore safeguarding the electrical grid with Dr. Ernest McDuffie from NIST. Also, efforts to recruit and retain top cybersecurity pros. FCA Answers 2:05 p.m. this Friday on 1500 a.m. online on your schedule at federalnewsradio.com, keyword FCA.
Sponsored by FCA International and brought to you by URS and McAfee.